Before I introduce Ian, let me remind you, as I've been reminded myself, do please fill out your feedback, and if indeed possible, to use the ISS 2013 web app. You can download on your smartphone of your choice. Otherwise, please write some comments on the paper forms. So, moving to Ian, let me please introduce Ian. He is currently the Queensland Law Society Vice President and is the 2014 President-elect. Ian has been in practice since 1990 and was first elected to the QLS Council in 2010. Currently a member of the Society's Council Executive, Audit and Investment Committee, Professional Conduct Committee and Accident Compensation and Tort Law Committee. Ian is a Director of the Law Council of Australia, a former State and National President of the Australian Lawyers Alliance, and has for many years been actively involved in advocating for the protection of the rights of individuals and access to justice issues. Ian has worked extensively in lobbying government and stakeholders on issues impacting the legal profession and those the profession represents, and particularly in relation to accident compensation. Ian is a principal with Maurice Blackburn at their Browns Plains office, a QLS accredited specialist in personal injuries law, and in addition to his work with QLS, undertakes volunteer work with the Logan Legal Advice Centre. Please join me in welcoming Ian.
Thank you for that. Everyone can hear me? I have my friend Kim Birch to thank for being here today, speaking at an actuaries conference. I never actually thought at any point in my career that I would do this, so this is a real career highlight for me. And there are about 20 people, 30 people more in this room than I had actually expected to be here. Because there's nothing more boring than hearing lawyers spout on about all sorts of manner of things that are critical of schemes and statistics. And I'll tell you, there is a complete lack of statistics in my presentation today. It's all about the vibe. So I hope you can come with me on this journey. It was very difficult for me to know on such a broad topic as a lawyer's perspective what exactly to address. So knowing how, again, how you are wedded to facts and figures, I've deliberately tried to steer away from that and talk to you about some sort of bigger picture issues. I want to talk about the role that lawyers play in maintaining the integrity of accident compensation schemes and the contribution that lawyers have made to the preservation of our schemes in Queensland. I want to talk briefly about the motor accident and the workers' compensation schemes in Queensland, and again, in terms of reform and evolution of those schemes, the role that lawyers have played. And I want to finally talk about the recent changes to the workers' compensation scheme in Queensland as a case study of a number of things. Probably not the least of which is the dangers of very hasty legislation and of the importance of engagement with stakeholders and particularly with the legal profession in terms of developing good policy. Good policy leads to good legislation good policy is generally formulated when there is appropriate level of consultation with key stakeholders, including the legal profession. I want to talk a little bit about the unforeseen consequences that can occur when the profession is not consulted in relation to legislation. I want to talk very briefly about the role that lawyers play in the maintenance of viable compensation schemes. Contrary to popular belief, lawyers are not all about plundering and pillaging compensation schemes. We are vitally concerned with the protection and preservation of viable compensation schemes. I've been a lawyer now for almost 25 years and I have acted almost entirely in that period for injured people, and I've represented literally thousands of injured people. And in that time, I have been always centrally concerned with ensuring that we have viable injury compensation schemes for people to access. And sometimes that has involved swallowing a bit of pill, several bit of pills, but we always, as lawyers, are centrally concerned with access to justice, and particularly for people who have been injured. Next year, I will assume the presidency of the Law Society, and I've no doubt that it will be a challenging period. It's been a very active 3-month period in Queensland in terms of legislation, as you'd probably be aware. A range of quite extraordinary legislative measures, from the amendments to our workers' compensation scheme through to bikie laws and to arbitrary detention of prisoners at the discretion of the Attorney-General. And those are all very, very significant issues that have occurred in Queensland. And for those of... Can I have a show of hands? Who's from Queensland? So the majority of the audience. For those of you who are not from Queensland, well, you're going to be on a steep learning curve because you are in the deep north now. We accept as lawyers that the will of the legislature and of the executive is paramount, and at the end of the day, government has policy agendas that they want to achieve and policy outcomes they want to achieve. But in order to achieve those policy outcomes, the profession is strongly of the view that we need to be consulted to ensure that those policy outcomes can be achieved in a within a legislative framework, and that there is an appropriate level of consultation with the relevant stakeholders. Historically, that has been the case, that when there has been significant change mooted to injury compensation schemes in Queensland, that there has been a close consultation with stakeholders, including the legal profession. That unfortunately has not been the case in relation to the changes to the workers' compensation scheme, and I'll talk a little bit about what the unforeseen consequences of that might be. Lawyers are uniquely placed to provide insights in relation to the drivers behind the behaviour of claimants in injury compensation schemes, because let's face it, what claimants do in injury compensation schemes is almost always going to be at the direction and upon the advice that a lawyer gives to them. So engaging with the profession to understand what those drivers might be is critical, particularly from an actuarial perspective, to understand what the relevant behaviours are and what is motivating those behaviours. Critically important in terms of the then and the now, but particularly what will happen in the future. Obviously, sound modelling requires not only all the black and white understanding of the facts and figures, but as I've said, how people within the scheme, the great variable in this, the great unknown, is always going to be the behaviour of claimants. Surely, it is critically important to have an understanding of how those behaviours are likely to unfold, particularly when you are discussing or contemplating significant change to compensation schemes. It is, like I've said earlier, the simple fact that lawyers, by and large, are committed to ensuring that people have access to justice. I looked recently at some statistics from the National Pro Bono Centre that indicated that, and this is conservatively, I undertook an actuarial analysis and extrapolated the figures and came up with a conservative figure of about $60 million per annum of pro bono work that's undertaken by solicitors. And that's just work that's undertaken and notified. There is a huge amount of work that's undertaken in relation to which solicitors simply don't charge. Free phone advice, solicitors charge far lower fees. So conservatively, I would expect that the figure in terms of pro bono work by solicitors would be in excess of $100 million a year in Queensland. And I think that gives... I don't know how much pro bono work is undertaken by actuaries. Put up your hand if you've undertaken pro bono work this year. So I think if I'd had an audience, and I don't mean to be critical here, if I'd had an audience of solicitors here in this room, you would have seen the vast majority of people put up their hands at that point. So I say that only to highlight that this isn't, we're not a mercenary profession that's simply in this for the money. there is a broader and a far deeper motivation for the vast majority of lawyers. So I want to talk briefly about some changes that have occurred in relation to the motor accident and the workers' compensation schemes in Queensland. So for those of you who are familiar with the scheme, the motor accident scheme, that's generally the broad history of what has occurred in Queensland. I was in practice when the Motor Accident Insurance Act was first introduced in 1994, even though I look much, much younger than that. I had been a solicitor for a number of years at that point. And I remember when that Act came in. And at that point, we had this concept introduced of insurers intervening at an early stage and being required to assist injured people with the provision of medical and rehabilitative treatment. And the whole concept behind the Motor Accident Insurance Act to encourage the speedy resolution of claims, that was a real culture shock for most solicitors. The concept of speedy resolution of a claim was a foreign concept for many people because, of course, we were accustomed to an open slather common law system where you simply kept all your cards close to your chest, filed proceedings in court and went off and had a trial, and it was a free-for-all. But we had the Motor Accident Insurance Act in 1994 and it wasn't embraced, I think would be true to say, and I think Kim Birch in the audience here will confirm that it was not embraced at an early stage by solicitors because it was just a completely foreign concept in terms of the behaviour of claimants and the behaviour of lawyers acting for claimants. And I recall, though, my exposure to the benefits of the scheme were very early on in the piece, and I represented a young lady who was injured after a night out with a group of friends in Toowoomba. And she had, none of them had been drinking. It was a perfectly reasonable night out. They weren't hooning. They were driving home. She was in the back seat of the car, and the vehicle left the road and hit a tree. It was just a moment inadvertence by the driver. And all of the people in the car were okay, relatively unharmed, except for my client, who was in the back seat. And it was just by some freak of circumstances that she slid partially out of her seatbelt and sideways across the seat and broke her spine. And she was a single mother who lived slightly out of Toowoomba. She had a little girl and she ran her own hairdressing business in Toowoomba. And so it was a real steep learning curve for me at that point in order to understand just what it was and what it wasn't that the Motor Accident Insurance Act could achieve for her. We ended up in one of the very first applications before the court for the provision of rehabilitation services for this particular young lady. And the argument with Suncorp was simply this. She owned her own home, as I've said, but it was a high-set home out in the country. She needed to be in the township of Toowoomba, in the city of Toowoomba. She wanted to try and access her business to keep it going, but she also needed to be able to access relevant medical and rehabilitation treatment. And Suncorp declined to pay for the rent to put her in a suitable dwelling in Toowoomba. As I've said, this was very early days in relation to the Motor Accident Insurance Act. The application was heard before Justice Byrne in the Supreme Court. And I recall this matter for so many reasons vividly, the most vividly being, though, that I had briefed a barrister who had argued the case. However, unfortunately, we got to the lunch adjournment and we hadn't actually concluded the application, at which point he said to me, "I cannot return in the afternoon. You will have to complete arguing this case." And I was absolutely terrified at the prospect of doing this. I don't know how many of you know Justice Byrne, but he can be a terrifying judge to appear before. But it was because this was just an unknown area of law. There was no case law around this, no understanding of how rehabilitation really worked, what it was meant to achieve, and just how far the court would go in persuading an insurer, I'll say persuading, an insurer to provide medical and rehab assistance. So we came back in the afternoon, and my ham-fisted efforts in the afternoon must have worked, because at the end of the day the judge ordered that Suncorp pay for the rent for this girl to live in accommodation, suitable accommodation, in Toowoomba. So that was my first exposure to the Motor Accident Insurance Act and to this brave new world of understanding the motivators and the drivers behind CTP claims. We learned very rapidly thereafter, some more rapidly than others, as lawyers, that really what this legislation was all about was there to help people to access treatment at a very early stage. And it was also a steep learning curve in forming a relationship of trust with an insurance company. Up to that point, obviously, we had only ever had adversarial dealings with insurers, generally not with them, generally with their solicitors. So we now entered this territory of dealing with CTP insurers directly, and not in a purely adversarial sense either, but dealing with insurers who were there to try and help, and so we had to learn to trust them, for example, if we let the insurer speak to the injured person, that the insurer wouldn't take that opportunity to try and ferret out information that might be to the detriment of the injured person. So that was a very steep learning curve for us to undertake and embark upon. It really has moved on from there considerably in terms of the lawyer's behaviour around CTP claims. There is no doubt that there are still recalcitrant practitioners who adopt a very adversarial approach, but by and large, solicitors have embraced the whole concept of working more closely with insurers, to the point now where it's almost a default position to allow an insurer to have direct communications with the client to assist them through the rehab process, to the point now where it's quite commonplace to have regular teleconference case conferences with the insurer and with the client to talk about where they are with their rehab and treatment and where they're going with it. So it's become a much more open experience with CTP insurers. And that's also been the case in relation to the litigious side of things as well, because we have now moved toward tentative steps at first, but I think increasingly more so where we engage in joint reporting with particular insurers. Some are better than others, obviously, but we encourage joint medico-legal reporting with insurers. And for the obvious reason that in most motor vehicle accident claims, the medicine isn't going to be particularly controversial. And generally speaking, if you can agree that there is a particular doctor, and there is a cohort of doctors who are perceived to be quite reasonable and appropriate doctors, who can provide a report, and it's accepted by both parties that they'll abide by whatever that doctor comes up with. So that whole concept of joint medico-legal reporting is being increasingly embraced. Perhaps not as much as I personally would like to see. Even within my own firm, there are solicitors who are very resistant to the idea of joint reporting. And there's still, I won't say vestiges, because it's more than that, there are still a significant cohort, I suppose, of solicitors who really do see the medico-legal side of things to be a very polarising process. We need the very best report we can at this end of the spectrum, because we know we're going to have to negotiate back to here. Whereas the reality, in my view, is that if you start here with the insurer, well, you're already halfway there. The other thing that was a significant change in relation to the Motor Accident Insurance Act were the developments in 1999 when we had the prohibition on touting. That was an issue that the profession did work actively to try and stamp out. At the time, and it's going back some many years now, the practice of touting at the scene of accidents was widespread. So at the scene of a motor vehicle accident, you would commonly see tow truck operators handing out lawyers' cards. You would commonly see people getting a knock on the door the day after an accident from a solicitor who would say, "I know you were injured in an accident yesterday. I've been given your details by so-and-so. Do you want to make a claim?" So that practice, and it went all the way through to hospitals as well. So you would find people in accident and emergency. You would find people in rehabilitation wards, essentially trawling the wards and looking for people and encouraging them to go to particular lawyers to make claims. And obviously, I remember that period of time quite vividly because at the time I was travelling in North Queensland, visiting law firms up and down the coast, talking to them about various things, and the practice was rife in regional hospitals in relation to touting. So certainly the profession did not want to see that kind of behaviour continue. It was resulting in damage to the scheme, and it was seeing a significant increase in the number of claims being made, and any number of those claims were unmeritorious in the sense that people were being encouraged to make claims in circumstances where they probably otherwise just wouldn't have considered making the claim. That type of very short-sighted action by particular law firms and quite unethical behaviour ultimately resulted, however, in significant restrictions on lawyer advertising that was subsequently introduced. Now, whether or not that would have occurred had the touting not occurred in the first place is unknown. And I will make this observation about the subsequent restrictions on advertising. My very strong view is that there is no correlation between lawyer advertising and claims. Most recently, we've seen politicians complaining bitterly about lawyer advertising and encouraging claims that ought not otherwise be made. But if you look at the statistics in terms of the claims rates in the motor accident scheme and in the workers' compensation scheme, if in fact that was the case, you would see those claims rates increasing, and they're not. They're either plateaued or decreasing. So there's no evidence to suggest there is any demonstrable correlation between lawyer advertising and claims rates. But I point out those two issues because they really were significant areas in which the legal profession took an active role in seeing significant change to the scheme that significantly then affected and amended behaviours by claimants and by the lawyers acting for claimants. The final point I'd make there in relation to the Civil Liability Act was in relation to the issue of the ISV. So what we had in 2002 again was a review of particular issues relating to the CTP scheme and pressures that were being placed on the scheme, and there was talk at that stage of the imposition of thresholds to access common law, thresholds certainly in respect of general damages. And the profession worked actively with government at that stage and with the Motor Accident Insurance Commission in relation to the introduction of injury scale values, which effectively regulate the amount of general damages, which in their way act as a de facto threshold. And again, that was an example of the pragmatic approach taken by the profession in relation to the motor accident insurance scheme to amend trends that were occurring in the scheme which were less than benign. In relation to the workers' compensation scheme, again, there's a very brief timeline of the relevant changes in relation to workers' compensation. But essentially, workers' compensation changes have mirrored to some extent the motor accident changes. That is, we moved from a laissez-faire system where it was simply a free-for-all at common law through to a more structured approach, which involves an extensive pre-court procedure and also an irrevocable election by workers as to whether they pursue common law or accept a what is usually a fairly modest lump sum offer of compensation by WorkCover. Again, in 2010, we saw the introduction of the injury scale value. I will make an observation, though, about the workers' compensation scheme. Firstly, the nature of dealing with workers' compensation claims when you're a lawyer is necessarily very different, or it was until the 15th of October, very different to how you would be involved in a motor accident claim. As a solicitor acting for an injured person in a motor vehicle accident claim, you necessarily insert yourself into the process right from the start. So you are involved as a lawyer with assisting the person through the entire claim, that is, from the medical and rehabilitation phase, in the acute phase when treatment is required, through to the assessment phase to determine if someone's reached a stable and stationary point, and then through to the pre-court litigation phase when you're talking about trying to resolve the matter, and then beyond that once the matter, if the matter becomes litigious. So the lawyer is involved at every stage of that process in CTP claims. And the very significant difference with WorkCover is that that does not occur, or hasn't historically occurred, certainly up until now. And that's for the simple reason that lawyers generally do not engage in the workers' compensation claim process until the statutory claim is completed. So the lawyer, so the worker has gone through the statutory phase, and they then look at being assessed for common law and moving beyond that, or being assessed for permanent impairment and moving into the common law phase. So I'll move quickly, because I've had the buzzer, to the recent changes to the workers' compensation scheme in Queensland. Now, just briefly, just so you understand the timeline here, 7th of June 2012, the Legislative Assembly in Queensland agreed to a motion that there be a review of the workers' compensation scheme, and it was through the Parliament's own committee process that the government set up. There were a number of hearings, many submissions made, many meetings held with politicians, with the Premier, with the Attorney, with the Treasurer. In May this year, the Parliamentary Committee handed down its report recommended that there be no significant changes to the workers' compensation scheme in Queensland, and specifically recommended against the imposition or the introduction of thresholds, impairment thresholds for access to common law. There were rumblings thereafter that the government might be thinking about doing something. There was continued denial by the government about any intention to act adversely to the common law rights of injured workers. And then, lo and behold, on the 14th of October 2013, Cabinet, without any warning, considered the matter, and on the 15th of October, legislation was introduced into the Parliament which imposed a 5% impairment threshold for access to common law, and amazingly, 2 days later, the legislation was passed without any consultation, without any referral to an appropriate committee, and on the basis that the legislation was, for some reason, completely unknown to anyone, that urgent. So now we have a completely changed workers' compensation landscape in Queensland. And I just want to mention very briefly some of the very significant issues that will arise as a result of what certainly the Law Society considers to be the hasty introduction of legislation which was never warranted or required. I see Lisa Simpson's in the room, so I'm sure she'll contradict me if I say anything here that's incorrect. But the reality is that both the actuaries for WorkCover and the actuaries for QComp were of the view that the scheme was in robust good health. There were no malignant trends at all in relation to the scheme at all, and all of the signs were benign, if not positive. There was also the issue that the changes that had been made to the workers' compensation scheme in 2010 had not been given sufficient time to flow through in terms of their beneficial effects. And that was continuing to be seen in the six-monthly reviews that were six-monthly stakeholder engagements where the actuaries spoke to us amongst all the other stakeholders and presented a picture of how the scheme was travelling. So now we have a completely changed scheme. So the first thing we've asked is, was there any actuarial analysis undertaken, detailed actuarial analysis undertaken of what the effects of the imposition of a 5% impairment threshold would be? Now, I don't expect anyone in the audience, and I see some suspects out there, I'm not going to single you out, and I don't expect you to give me an honest answer to that now, but later you could. I won't share it with anyone. But we want to know whether or not that actuarial analysis was undertaken. If there had been a consultation with the legal profession, obviously there would be a number of things that we would have pointed out, not the least of which was that the imposition of a 5% impairment threshold was never going to be a straight linear equation in terms of saying these claims are now all gone. Because let's face it, there is historically been very little, if no dispute, about work-related impairment because it's irrelevant, has been irrelevant, for workers to access common law. So there will be a huge percentage of claims now that will be disputed and go off to the Medical Assessment Tribunal. Every single conceivable injury that a worker has sustained in an accident will be included in a claim. The fact of the matter is that lawyers now will insert themselves into the workers' compensation claims process right from the beginning. And there'll be a number of reasons for that, not the least of which is it's going to be a risk management issue for solicitors down the track when they're giving advice to clients. And if a client says, well, I didn't get over the impairment threshold, why not? The solicitor is going to have to be able to say, well, I left no stone unturned to get you over that threshold if that was at all possible. So it will mean that every conceivable injury will need to be covered off. It will mean that solicitors will engage in the statutory process in workers' compensation very much in the same way as they engage in the CTP claims process. They will become active in the sense of advising clients, guiding clients in relation to how they approach their medical and rehabilitative treatment and also generally in relation to, as I've said, all of the injuries that might have been sustained in a particular incident. Lawyers will be assisting claimants to in relation to decision making when WorkCover or a self-insurer is making determinations about ceasing a statutory claim, declining to provide certain medical treatment, declining to continue the payment of certain benefits. Solicitors will insert themselves into that process necessarily to assist the injured person, and therefore we will see a rapid escalation in disputation rates in workers' compensation claims in Queensland. There will be a huge increase in the number of referrals to the Medical Assessment Tribunal. Conservatively, it's likely to be at least another 1,500 referrals per annum to the Medical Assessment Tribunals, and it could be 2,500. At the present time, the Medical Assessment Tribunals in Queensland have reached saturation point. There are no more doctors who can undertake medical assessments.
That's not Santa Claus coming. That's our bell reminding us we have 5 minutes to go. With enormous respect to your presentation, I wonder if we can wrap it up and give the audience an opportunity to throw questions at you.
Absolutely. I won't rabbit on about this because I think that it's self-evident, the point that I'm trying to make, and that is that there are going to be significant changes to the workers' compensation scheme in Queensland, significant impacts upon costs in the scheme, and no evidence, at least that we know of, that these have been properly considered, and certainly no consultation with the legal profession, which we would have pointed out these particular issues going forward. Finally, there will be a cost shift. There will be a cost shift away from employers because people will seek to pursue claims against third parties, and that will affect insurance premiums there, and it will also be bad for business in Queensland because there's already anecdotal evidence that employers are looking to, host employers are looking to direct hire workers, avoiding labour hire agencies so that they get the benefit of the protections in respect of common law and disclosure in relation to previous medical conditions. So I'll just conclude by saying that the legal profession does have a particular and active interest in the preservation of viable compensation schemes in Queensland, and historically that has always been the case. The point I would like to leave you with is simply this, that where you don't consult, where government doesn't consult with key stakeholders in relation to legislative reform, the unforeseen consequences of that can be far worse than the problem or the policy objective they're trying to achieve in the first place. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Ian. We do have a couple of minutes of time for questions. Please, can I remind you to speak into the microphone provided and identify yourself.
Kim Birch from the Madrox Insurance Commission. Thanks for that, Ian. I suppose I want to pull it back to the theme of the conference is about balancing outcomes. And this conference has had a lot of focus around perhaps schemes are changing, perhaps schemes are less about being adversarial and more about actually looking at the health recovery and life recovery for people that are injured through no fault of their own or through fault of their own. And it's about balancing the costs of that, because ultimately someone pays, as you pointed out, and whether it be a CTP insurer or a business owner in your particular examples. So somebody's got to pay and somebody's got to lose something to enable the community to afford the benefits of the broader scheme. So how do we reconcile those things without the wrath of the law society or the lawyers with unforeseen consequences?
Well, look, Kim, the point I would make is simply this, that we fully support, if I'm reading the subtext correctly there, the idea of an appropriate level of support for people with significant disability. And that is obviously the NDIS. And in concept, the NIIS has many things to recommend it. But, and this is a big but, the question is affordability. The question is, do you take away the rights of people that presently exist in order to potentially create an outcome that descends to the lowest common denominator? And that's the significant concern that the legal profession would have, certainly the Law Society would have, in relation to any changes to our accident compensation schemes in Queensland. They historically, demonstrably, on every indicator, are the best performing in the country. Well, they were certainly up until the 15th of October in respect of work cover. Beyond that, we don't know. But up until that point, they certainly were the best. And we don't want to see any action taken that is likely to jeopardise that and reduce the existing rights that people have. I note that Maurice Newman spoke about this recently, the chair of the Federal Government's Business Advisory Council, in which he commented about the NDIS and commented that it was simply not affordable.
Thank you. With that, we've run out of time, unfortunately, so it remains to thank Ian for his presence and for his presentation.